Chapter 15, How to Survive Professional Training with Your Values Intact. On the 30th of December, 1981, the United States Army issued a survival manual for graduate school, but no one recognized Field Manual number 21-78 as anything of the kind. True, the 108-page how-to book wasn't written for graduate students. It was written to show soldiers how to resist brainwashing and exploitation as prisoners of war. But in light of what we saw in the previous chapter, students in graduate or professional school should be able to put such resistance techniques to good use. In fact, in a crucial way, the military manual is superior to civilian advice books written specifically for students in graduate or professional school. The problem with the civilian guidebooks is that they simply help you conform successfully to the demands of the training institution. You get your credential, but lose your identity in the process. The Army manual, on the other hand, shows you how to survive the training program and keep control over your identity. The military calls this honorable survival, and in this chapter I will quote extensively from the Army manual about how to achieve it. Mere survival is, of course, a precondition for honorable survival, but it doesn't get you even halfway there. In graduate school, as in the POW camp, the toughest struggle is not over whether you will survive the process, but over what sort of person you will be when you get out. Thus, if you want to become a professional to be in a better position to pursue your own vision, then the most difficult step is making sure you will still have your own vision after going through professional training. Here I am assuming that you are not a fan of the status quo, with its tired old ways that make work boring, its bureaucracy that takes the fun out of innovation, its decision-making that defies common sense, and its just-fine-thank-you old guard that sets the cautious tone. Rather, I assume your vision is forward-looking, and that one reason you want to become a professional is to have some power to further it. But after professional training, will your attitude still be critical and independent, or will it be uncritical and subordinate? If you don't think attitude is the big issue in professional training, take a look at the civilian guidebooks. In his popular graduate school survival guide, Robert L. Peters makes rare use of italics to warn that if you want to get what you came for, then you had better, quote, make it a firm rule never to say bad things within the university community. Every conscientious guidebook author who accepts the training system for what it is comes to this same conclusion, which speaks volumes about the true nature of graduate education. This requirement of strict attitude control is reminiscent of cult indoctrination, in which the rules for survival are the same, only more explicit. Here's how a former member of The Way International described it. All the time you have to think positive and speak positive. You can't have negative emotions. You battle any negative feelings. You become out of touch with your feelings. You don't go by your feelings. You go by the word of God. The people who run the group are the spiritual leaders. So they can say, when you write your diary, don't write anything negative, and you just do it. You write the positives. You write the word of God. They can have your twig coordinator, local group leader, read your diary and make sure you didn't write anything negative. They can do that when you're in the Way Corps, the leadership training program that I was in. The Way Corps is like 100% commitment. The people in it are considered the top of the line, the cream of the crop. Close quote. With or without guidebooks, a lot of students make it through professional training but give up the heart of their identity in the process. I'll call these students Group 1. Many others don't finish the program, but do hold on to who they are, Group 2. Only a fortunate few get through graduate or professional school with their attitude and values intact, Group 3. How do they do it? Students in all three groups have run-ins with the faculty. Even students who follow a mainstream guidebook and make a conscious effort to adopt the favored attitude and values eventually find themselves targeted for a hard time because they inevitably underestimate just how thoroughly they are expected to conform. Those headed for the first two groups defend their identity unconsciously, never recognizing that their attitude and values are at the root of their conflicts with the faculty. Bewildered by the trouble they are having, and therefore unsure about their own culpability, these students don't feel they have the right to demand that the faculty accept them for who they are. So they either back away from who they are and end up in the first group, or back away from demanding acceptance and end up in the second group. The few individuals who make it into the third group have one thing in common. At some point during their professional training, they stand up for their values, fight it out with the faculty, and win the right to be different. Attitudes and values atrophy if not acted upon, and so students make it into the third group only if they find a survivable way to take a stand for their beliefs. Because of the disparity in power between students and faculty, the student can't go it alone. Hence, the formula for surviving professional training with your attitude and values intact is, in a word, organize. Work with others and fight for your values consciously. You are going to have conflict in any case, so you might as well do it right and retain control of your identity. The same word, organize, summarizes the military's advice. And I'm reading from Discipline Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. I'm reading Chapter 15, Surviving Professional Training with Your Values Intact. Going on to the next subsection, Prisoner of War Resistance. Simple reasoning led me to the Army Field Manual. I figured that because professional training shares so many essential features with brainwashing, somewhere there must already exist a uniquely insightful survival manual for professional training, in the form of instructional material on resisting brainwashing. All I needed to do was find it. I expected the military to be knowledgeable in mind control, running as it does a massive indoctrination program of its own, in which it turns fresh recruits into people with a military mentality. In particular, I expected the military to know effective resistance techniques that captured troops can use if they don't want to be re-indoctrinated. So I called the Pentagon, and sure enough, soon I was talking to Colonel John Chapman, head of the Joint Services Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape Agency, SEER. The colonel explained that his 100-person organization, which is headquartered in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, debriefs returned captives, produces survival, evasion, resistance, and escape training material, and oversees SEER training in the various branches of the military. He offered the assistance of the head SEER psychologist, Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Jessen, Ph.D., I keep him out at Fairchild because we do some training out there, said Chapman, referring to the Air Force base in Washington State. He asked Jessen to put together a bibliography on resistance. When Chapman faxed me the result, he explained that we build our training around these references and some of our own references. The bibliography contained publications that were clearly, though inadvertently, relevant to professional training, and that in turn led me to other such documents. Two major themes ran throughout these publications: commitment to ideals and solidarity among the targets of indoctrination. The Army Field Manual is the best of the documents, as it synthesizes everything into one practical guide, titled Prisoner of War Resistance. Its contents come from debriefings of former prisoners of war, as well as from researchers who studied the subject. After the Army issued the manual, it tightened its restriction on revealing its resistance techniques, and so the second edition of Field Manual 21-78, issued in 1989, is a classified document. We don't want the people who potentially will hold our individuals as captives to know what we teach them to do to deal with it, Jessen told me. But the first edition of the manual had already let the cat out of the bag. This chapter presents some excerpts from it. If you're a student in graduate or professional school, you should have no trouble seeing how the military's hard-won lessons apply to the situation in your particular program. In fact, you will likely find it hard not to make the connections. But you don't have to be a student for this subordination resistance manual to strike a resonant chord in your life, because its insights will apply to all social hierarchies. If you were an employee, for example, application to your workplace will leap out at you. I have divided the excerpts into five overlapping subtopics. Knowing what you're up against, in the military's words, some basic captor approaches, preparing to take action, resistance training, working with others, make a team effort, resisting subordination, resist, and dealing with weak links, willing collaboration. Keep in mind that every subordinating institution has its own way of bringing about the oppressive conditions discussed in the manual. In a professional training program, for example, time pressure, insecurity, stress, and an overly demanding schedule can lead to lack of sleep, junk food diets, and social isolation. In a POW camp, by contrast, an indoctrinator might simply arrange for sleep deprivation, poor nutrition, and isolation. The mechanism is different, but the result is similar. Because of the essential similarity of hierarchical institutions, tailoring the POW resistance manual to your school or workplace requires nothing more than a few simple word substitutions. A frightening fact when you think about it. Graduate students, for example, might substitute graduate or professional school for PW camp, student for soldier, PW or man, institution or faculty for the captors, expel for kill, upheld values for honor, graduate with your values intact for escape or honorable survival, job for big ticket item, being obsequious for bowing, institutions for nations, and so on. Use your imagination and have fun. Prisoner of War Resistance. The battle in the prisoner of war camp is for the mind. And this is an excerpt from the manual. As a PW, your own most powerful and valuable weapon is resistance. It is the only honorable course of action. Resistance can mean the difference between respectful or disrespectful treatment, walking out of a PW camp or coming feet first, returning with honor or returning in disgrace, failure or success as escape, pride or shame, looked up to or down by the other PW's family and friends. Resistance is the ability to mold the PW environment to your needs and objectives. Work and cooperate with the other PWs. Every man for himself does not work in a PW camp. The only way to defeat your captor is to unite and organize. Knowing what you're up against. There are only a few ways to get people to adopt the right attitude within a set amount of time, say during the course of a professional training program or during a probationary period on a job. The methods are simple, and people who are given power over others, say the power to deny degrees or fire employees, quickly rediscover them on their own. Students and employees who are familiar with these attitude-altering techniques and setups, some of which are mentioned below, will be better able to hold on to their values. And again from the field manual, some basic captor approaches. As a PW, you must meet the challenges of loneliness, fatigue, fear, anger, monotony, isolation, a hostile, enemy-imposed environment. The psychological effect of captivity may be greater and last longer than the physical effects. Your captor will work to try to break you, to try to weaken your belief in yourself and your will to keep your identity and maintain your lifetime code of ethics, decency, and standards of behavior. Generally, the enemy does not want to kill PWs for one major reason. Among others, a dead PW cannot be exploited. Enemy can bring about disordered mental function. No amount of willpower can prevent it. Your captors don't have to use physical brutality. Extreme fatigue, lack of sleep, and pain, for example, can cause it. Complex mental functions are lost first. The ability to carry out highly creative activities. There is less concern about morality and right and wrong. Generally, socially oriented behavior falls away. Your captor will try to disgrace you in the eyes of others, especially your fellow prisoners. Or he will try to make you feel disgraced and ashamed of yourself. What's the use of resisting technique? Using this approach, your captor tries to make you quit resisting by saying, for example, "What's the use of holding out? Why suffer? You are at our mercy. We can do what we want with you." Or he may put it to you this way, "You're not going anywhere. You'll be here a long time. Why not make it easier on yourself? Cooperate, and we'll see that your stay here is pleasant." Method shows power over life and death. How they do it. Captor show of power, i.e., executions, torture, starvation, favors, good clothing, medical care, food, and shelter, or deprived of food, medical care, etc. Complete control of physical conditions in a camp. Uncertainty of not knowing when or why treatment will change is a threat. What it does, makes PW know who is boss, who runs the show, who pulls the strings. Breeds extreme caution among PWs. Evidence of power over life hits home. Method, deliberately caused physical deterioration. How they do it. Extremely long interrogation and forced writing sessions, making the PW overly tired. Insufficient, poorly prepared, unpalatable, non-nourishing, monotonous, strange food. What it does, drastic lowering of PW's resistance level to interrogation, indoctrination, exploitation. Method, now and then kind of treatment. How they do it, favors. Now and then, better living conditions, food, clothes, shelter, surroundings. Easy interrogation. Teases with a small desirable item, letting the PW know that he can get a big ticket item for complying with captor wishes. Promises other rewards for compliance. what it does. Tries to build a he's not such a bad guy attitude in the PW. Makes resistance seem like a bad time and undesirable compared with the luxuries the captor can give. The indoctrination process may be gradual. They know that a person who convinces himself that something is right or wrong, good or bad, is a better and more lasting convert than one who has ideas stuffed down his throat. Your captor wants to make you, the captured soldier, both the propagandist and the object of propaganda. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, reading Surviving Professional Training with Your Values Intact. The next subsection on resisting indoctrination, preparing to take action. People in subordinate positions naturally ready themselves to deal with those above them in the hierarchy, but they don't always admit to themselves that that is what they are doing. Students and employees, for example, take a keen interest in any information they can get about the professors or managers they must face. They eagerly share their information and analysis of it. They learn from individuals who have more experience dealing with the authorities and teach those who have less. Stories of past struggles at their schools or workplaces, at other schools or workplaces, are of special interest. The excerpts below assume that serious, conscious study of your situation is wise. From the Field Manual. Resistance Training. Training should make the soldier self-reliant and a team worker. He must understand that both are needed for success on any battlefield. Proper training impresses personnel with the values of and the need for group loyalty, unity, and action, while training them to understand the full extent of their own abilities. Training should teach him not only to reach deeply within himself for courage and initiative in times of stress, but to reach out to his fellow soldiers to help them to assure that he lives and succeeds through their survival and success. Training should give each soldier confidence in his ability to deny the enemy information and resist interrogation, exploitation, and indoctrination. Training should emphasize the psychological aspects of interrogation, indoctrination, exploitation, and isolation, so that the trainee, if captured, will know what to expect and can better resist the enemy. Life, sanity, reputation may depend upon the quality and thoroughness of this training. To resist successfully, a PW must know his captors. Culture, customs, social standards, economic way of life, political structure, system of justice, relationships with other nations, overall strategy regarding the handling of PWs, long-range plans, general methods for gaining objectives, i.e. torture, mental stress, the carrot-and-stick approach, etc. With this information, a PW can plan suitable resistance. Be familiar with the captor's reasons for and methods of attempting to indoctrinate prisoners politically. Be familiar with the methods of resisting such indoctrination. Working with others. Organizing is almost magically empowering, but it is very difficult, even under the best circumstances. The difficulties remain essentially the same even when the individuals to be organized are subordinate in very different ways. Janitors in an office building, doctors employed by an HMO, students in graduate school, minorities in a racist institution, any subordinate group can benefit from solidarity and can learn valuable principles and tactics from the struggles of other groups. The politics of power are universal. And from the Army Manual again, make a team effort. Prisoners of war must present a united front to the enemy. While individually they may be weak, as a unified group they are strong. help each other, and make sacrifices whenever necessary. A PW environment puts a man and his will to the test. Keep your differences to yourself. Work them out quietly. If you don't, your captor will try to exploit them. Do not bring upon a fellow prisoner that which you would not have them bring upon you. Place unity above self. Unified PWs represent a serious threat to the enemy, to their plans and achievement of objectives. Live and work as a member of a cooperating, cohesive unit. Use U.S. names and ranks in addressing each other, not names or ranks conferred by the enemy. When there are several or many PWs, communications and organization are possible and necessary. To resist the enemy effectively and to give each PW a better chance to escape, it is important to set up a PW organization. Learn the names and locations of other PWs. Learn the status and state of well-being of each. Learn their relationship with the enemy, collaborators, informers, traitors, neutral, and non-committed, or okay all the way. Experience has proven that some individuals are not blessed with sufficient levels of education, training, faith, character, or pride on which to draw for defenses. These people cannot be discarded or left to flounder by themselves. They must be helped. They must be brought into and made an integral part of the PW unit. They must be given responsibilities within their capabilities, perhaps a little beyond their capabilities, and helped to achieve them by encouraging and actively assisting if necessary. To bring them into the mainstream of the PW activities and unit is a major test of leadership and unity. At some time or other, a feeling of remoteness hits every PW. Away from family and friends, he gets that feeling of being away from it all. It is a dangerous feeling. It can bring about a complete separation from reality. It may make the PW feel he has been forgotten and abandoned. And his captor makes every effort to make the PW believe it. He tries to instill a feeling of being alone and abandoned, but as a PW, you are a part of something, some group, some organization. You are not remote from your responsibilities toward the outfit. They are real. Carry them out. Others will work with you. As long as that happens, you are in the real world. You will stay in touch with reality. You may, regardless of rank or grade, become a key figure among other PWs. Look to for leadership guidance and advice. The PW camp is a place where each soldier proves his courage. And that was an excerpt from a U.S. Army field manual for prisoners of war. I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. He wrote, I managed to get through graduate school with my non-mainstream attitude and values mostly intact. I will describe some of that experience as an example of how one graduate student handled the inevitable conflict. When I arrived at the physics department at the University of California, Irvine, I found fearful and stressed out graduate students and a generally repressive atmosphere. I knew that if I adopted the favored mainstream behavior, even as a disingenuous act, my thinking would slowly and insidiously become more and more mainstream as well. As an undergraduate campus activist, I had seen how students who sat out the struggles of the day slowly became more and more conservative. So I decided to fake the favored attitude, but not the favored behavior. I would behave in accord with my real beliefs whenever I could get away with it. I decided to lie low at first so the faculty would pass me on the physics PhD qualifying examination. I didn't want them to look at my test papers and quote-unquote find that I didn't know enough physics. So before the test, I limited my participation in campus life to writing a few op-ed articles in the student newspaper. I knew that physics faculty members would disagree with the radical point of view that I took in these articles, but I also knew that if I chose topics far from the world of physics, the liberal professors would see the articles simply as a nice exercise of free speech by one of their students, who, after all, had the proper subordinate attitude where it counted, within the physics department. I also signed on with a faculty member and started collaborating with him on a research project, my dissertation project, so that I might have an advocate at exam evaluation time. After they passed me on the exam, I knew it would be more difficult for them to find an excuse to get rid of me, so I slowly increased my political activity. Another physics graduate student and I organized an unofficial science and society seminar in the department, focusing mainly on the politics of science. We brought in progressive faculty members from other departments, or gave talks ourselves, to stimulate lunchtime discussions, which attracted undergraduate and graduate students and occasionally faculty members. Eventually, I encouraged students from physics and other departments to form a local chapter of the activist organization Science for the People. Our group was strong and sponsored a number of study groups and well-attended events that allowed a radical point of view to be heard on controversial issues as diverse as sociobiology, faculty military research, and U.S. foreign intervention. Many of our actions hit close to home in the physics department, which we used as a base of operations in part because many of our members were physics students. The faculty knew I was one of the organizers, but they had to be careful because the mere existence of the organization constituted a threat that any repressive action on their part would be publicized and would mobilize people against them. In one of our many actions, we confronted the head of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Laboratory when he spoke on campus before a large audience at a colloquium sponsored by the physics department. Harold Agnew, then director of the New Mexico Laboratory, had been invited to campus by his friend Frederick Raines, an Irvine physics professor who had worked on the hydrogen bomb at Los Alamos. Agnew had been a strong advocate of developing the neutron bomb, a nuclear weapon capable of killing people inside buildings while leaving the buildings perfectly intact. He had explained to a Senate subcommittee what the bomb would do to a person. In a very short time, he would become very ill and would be incapacitated. In a day or so, he would be dead. Close quote. When Agnew took questions after his talk, we demanded that he explain why, as the head of a supposedly politically neutral science laboratory, he had assigned what he described as a, quote, very elite group of scientists to lobby, quote, very aggressively in favor of the neutron bomb. He refused to give details. Later, at the beginning of the post-colloquium wine and cheese reception for him, I and others questioned him in an unfriendly way about the morality of his nuclear weapons work. Agnew lost his temper, and Raines had to hustle him out of the room. Raines was extremely embarrassed by our violation of the protocol for how to treat the director of a national laboratory, and he was furious with me in particular for leading the attack. As a member of the Los Alamos Old Boys Network and a big-time grantsman, Raines had a lot of power within the physics department. Faculty members were afraid to challenge him even though they didn't think he was particularly good at physics. Raines' anger was of more than academic concern to me because he paid my salary as a research assistant. Raines had agreed to allocate a tiny chunk of money from one of his multi-million-dollar Department of Energy research contracts to finance a small project directed by my dissertation advisor, Riley Newman, and my salary was paid out of that. But Raines limited his retribution to a verbal attack against me at the next meeting of his research group. Another incident involving our organization hit the faculty closer to home. One of Raines' own graduate students, Scott Nakamura, suffered a fatal cerebral hemorrhage while working in one of Raines' laboratories. Scott was from a working-class family in Hawaii and had gone much farther in school than anyone else in his family. His many friends and fellow Science for the People members knew that it would mean a lot to Scott's parents if the department were to recognize his 8 years of graduate work by awarding his Ph.D. posthumously. When another student and I approached Raines with the suggestion, he rejected it out of hand, explaining that the Ph.D. is the, quote, coin of the realm and must not be devalued. The department issued a master's degree instead, but we argued to no avail that that represented only the first 2 or 3 years of Scott's graduate work. So we circulated a petition which forced the chairman of the physics department to appoint a committee, chaired by Raines, to decide the matter. Raines was furious, as were the department chairman and the other senior faculty members, that the petitioners had not accepted Raines' initial decision as final and were drawing ever wider attention to a denial that made the department look cold-hearted. The committee invited the students to testify under the icy glare of its chairman and ended up issuing Scott a C. Phil, which ranks between a master's degree and a Ph.D. The senior faculty members, angry that their authority had been successfully challenged, moved to discipline the graduate students involved. Each student was punished in some way and warned by his dissertation advisor that if he wanted to get his own degree, he should mind his own business and concentrate on his work. My advisor, Riley Newman, happened to be in Oxford, England, on a sabbatical leave at the time this all happened. And so the department handled my case somewhat differently. They saw me as a more dedicated opponent than the other students involved and clearly wanted me out. But by then I was only a couple of months from completing my dissertation, and so the only practical way to get rid of me, ironically, was to help me finish it. In Newman's absence, physics professor Jonas Schultz had been checking the chapters of my dissertation as I completed them. Schultz had always been rather slow to respond, but suddenly and mysteriously, my dissertation seemed to become his highest priority. One Friday, Schultz told me that Raines had phoned from Los Alamos to ask if my dissertation would be typed by Monday. Schultz knew that many weeks' worth of work remained to be done, and so told Raines regretfully that his suggestion was impractical. When Monday came around, Raines tried to take possession of my dissertation from my typist. He wanted to put two typists to work on it simultaneously, to give me a Ph.D. and get me out of the department without my advisor even seeing the dissertation. But the typist, his former secretary, whom he was paying to do the job, knew about my conflict with him and refused to hand it over. I finished it 6 weeks later. At the same time, without Newman's approval, Raines fired me, taking me off the payroll as a research assistant. I claimed this was retaliation for exercising free speech, and after I completed the degree, I demanded 6 weeks' pay, because standard practice in Raines' research group had been to employ students until they completed their degrees. When my advisor returned from sabbatical and asked Raines about my dismissal, Raines told him in a voice of finality, "He can have his vacation pay, but that's all." This was a small concession, Because department practice was to cheat research assistants out of their vacations by asking them to report vacation days on their month's timesheets without actually taking any time off. 7 physics graduate students wrote a letter to the department chairman supporting me, and when I mentioned the dispute to the head of the faculty union, mathematics professor Joel Westman, he offered to take up my case. It was highly unusual, of course, for the faculty union to take a case against a faculty member, but the union didn't want to see any university employee fired for political activity. Raines at first rebuffed Westman, but then capitulated and asked Newman, "What do I have to do to settle this?" Newman told him the amount I had calculated, and Raines paid up. I donated the money to the faculty union. My history of troublemaking didn't interfere with my getting a job after graduation. By the time word of it got to my boss at Physics Today magazine, which had hired me as an associate editor, I was already through the probationary period and was again busy making trouble for managers who deserved it. The one who belatedly outed my bad attitude to the Physics Today management was Irvine physics professor Gregory Benford, a plasma physicist with military connections discussed in Chapter 5, whose attempt to join my dissertation committee I had blocked. In a telephone conversation that I learned about accidentally, Benford spelled out my political beliefs to my very interested boss, Gloria B. Lubkin, then editor of Physics Today. He also gave her details about my political activities. Lubkin put this information into my personnel matters file in her office. Example, quote, "He believes in revolution in all countries," close quote. The notion that in the United States an employee's political views are not a personnel matter is, of course, only a pretense. As we have seen, the boss's high priority on control over the workforce and control over the political content of the work requires them to be concerned about the attitudes and values of their employees. I oppose political dossiers on employees not because their content is so often inaccurate, but because their content often is accurate and facilitates this control. Files and Finks, however, rarely change the final outcome of conflicts. The amount of solidarity or potential solidarity is the determining factor. Yes, people who favor the status quo tend to get treated better than their less conservative colleagues. However, at the same time, people willing to take a stand often get treated better than people with a butt-kissing attitude, who often get taken advantage of. Hence, for example, despite my radical views, as a student and then as a working professional, I have found myself harassed and exploited less than other students and co-workers. The faculty and bosses have treated me with greater respect, gotten on my case much less frequently, given me greater autonomy, and accepted less work from me, making my daily life much less stressful. They tend to do the most to those who will take the most. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. And continuing on to the conclusion of Chapter 15, this is the next subcaption titled Individual Violence. Most people don't expect professional training programs at institutions of higher education to be the scene of cold-blooded murder. They are naive. When they think of professional training, they probably think of kindly bearded professors conveying important knowledge to eager young students. They don't think of institutions attempting to break students into a lifetime of political subordination, or of institutions holding students' futures hostage to encourage them to get with the program. The stakes in professional education are clearly high enough that grievances can lead to violence. The chance of violence is increased when the students in a university department have no independent organization to fight for power within the department. Then students have no way to lessen the fear and isolation that pervades so many programs. The power gained through organizing reduces insecurity, the source of the fear. The fight itself builds solidarity, reducing the cutthroat competition that is the source of the isolation. And the organization can represent individuals with grievances. But without an independent organization, students who feel unjustly treated must either swallow the injustice or take on those with power alone. As a result, there is enough violence that some weeks parts of the Chronicle of Higher Education are reminiscent of big city tabloids. Wayne State professor gunned down in class, read one recent headline on an article reporting that yet another graduate student had killed his doctoral advisor. Students who carry out deadly violence don't all have the same depth of understanding of their problem's origins. Thus, the violence follows all of the possible patterns: suicide, killing, suicide, and killing. A brief look at one example of each shows how at least three students perceived the issues. Jason Altum killed himself on the 15th of August, 1998. He was the fourth chemistry graduate student at Harvard University to commit suicide since 1981. Altum was considered the top graduate student in the research group headed by his advisor, Nobel Prize winner Elias J. Corey, a prominent chemist known for his work on the synthesis of organic molecules. Nevertheless, in a handwritten letter that he left behind, Altum blamed his suicide on Corey and the system that fails to protect graduate students from abusive research advisors. Indeed, Corey's relationship to Altum resembled that of a cult leader to a member. Like a cult leader, Corey was both revered and feared. Revered for his chemistry, and feared for his ability to make or break the careers of his graduate students. To Altum, Corey was, quote, like God, said one chemistry graduate student, a friend of Altum's. The only opinion about chemistry that mattered to Jason was Corey's, said another. Throughout the department, students commonly worked with religious fervor, toiling late into the night, 7 days a week. In many research groups, no amount of work was seen as sufficient. Thus, some students tried to create the illusion that they were always around. By leaving the lights on in their labs, by leaving a decoy coat out in a prominent spot, by keeping a magnetic stirrer spinning in a beaker of liquid. Altum often worked 13 or more hours per day, always scrambling to come up with something new to say to Corey, who was checking on his progress twice a day. Professors here have too much power over the lives of their graduate students, wrote Altum, who was almost 27 years old and had devoted 5 years of his life to graduate school in preparation for an academic job. To have a chance of success in the looming, highly competitive academic job market, Altum needed Corey's full support. But some harsh criticism from Corey convinced Altum that such support was not in the cards. Altum's suicide helped push the chemistry department to accept a student proposal that slightly diluted the power of advisors over their students. Now students can ask two additional faculty members to play a small advisory role. The professors who run the department had rejected the same proposal 3 years earlier. But those in charge still don't want fundamental change. In a telling effort to have their cake and eat it too, that is, to avoid violent attrition without fundamentally changing their stress-inducing approach to education, The professors arranged to offer their graduate students psychiatric help off-campus and at department expense. Yes, the Harvard Chemistry Department now has its own on-call psychiatrist. Gang Lu killed his physics dissertation advisor on November 1, 1991, along with three other physicists, a university administrator, and himself. The physics faculty at the University of Iowa considered Lu to be among the top five graduate students ever to enroll in their department, which has a worldwide reputation in space physics research. Lu dispatched each of his pre-selected targets with execution-style gunshots to the head, without speaking a word about what he was doing. However, the night before the shootings, Lu wrote a goodbye letter to his sister and composed a long public statement in which he discussed his personal history, his 6 years as a physics graduate student, and each of the people he killed the next day. The unreferenced quotes below are from those writings. Lu's advisor, space physics theorist Christoph E. Gertz, drove his graduate student research assistants relentlessly. Lu was a hard worker, but Gertz, a NASA grantsman, thought he wasn't working hard enough. Gertz got on Lu's case and began pushing him by piling on the work and making spot checks on him in his office. Lu felt that Gertz exploited his research assistants, and Lu didn't hide his views from others in the department. Gertz could be extremely tough on students whom he perceived as lagging, and so his students competed for his favor. Lin Hua Shan, another outstanding student in Gertz's group, beat Lu in this competition by working longer hours, by frequently soliciting Gertz's advice, and by better concealing his own very real dislike for Gertz. I've been honest and frank for my whole life, and I've suffered for being that kind of person, said Lu, who saw Shan as a butt-kisser. I have most of all detested cunning, fawning sycophants and dishonest bureaucrats. Shan was one of the physicists whom Lu killed. After the killings, one graduate student in the department was brave enough to say that if Gertz hadn't pressured Lu and Shan so much, the two might have had a different, less competitive relationship. But they did compete, and Gertz ended up showing favoritism towards Shan. This left Lu feeling targeted for mistreatment in both small and big ways. When one of Lu's calculations didn't turn out as Gertz had expected, Gertz immediately assumed that Lu had made a mistake. This upset Lu, especially when it turned out that Gertz was the one who had made a mistake. For the typical student, the defense of dissertation is just a ritual because the professors on the student's dissertation committee have already read the dissertation and brought any concerns to the student's attention. At Lu's dissertation defense, however, professors raised new questions, and they did so in a way that humiliated Lu. The department chairman was particularly harsh. To address the committee's new questions, Lu had to work day and night for a week redoing calculations, only to find that his results were right in the first place. Lu was hoping to win a university prize for his dissertation, but he discovered accidentally that the department chairman had consulted with the faculty and decided which student to nominate 2.5 months before the contest deadline, before all of Lu's committee members had seen his completed dissertation. The prize went to Shan, the favored student. Lu appealed the chairman's procedure to university officials, but was repeatedly rebuffed. At every level, the investigation of Lu's complaint consisted of a university official talking to the physics department chairman and getting his assurance that the department had given Lu's dissertation fair consideration. Lu felt that the department wasn't enthusiastic about helping him get a job, and that Gertz wouldn't write good letters of recommendation for him. Gertz heard about Lou's concerns and insisted on writing the letters, but then missed several deadlines, invalidating Lou's job applications. Thus, at age 28, and after 10 years of intense undergraduate and graduate study, Lou had no job prospects. Lou's sister holds the university responsible for the 6 deaths. One of her insights about her brother certainly applies to many other aspiring scholars who have taken violent action, and to many who haven't. Because he devoted his entire being to his studies, as the university demanded, blocking his way was tantamount to destroying him. Thus Lou destroyed the people whom he felt had destroyed him. Usually an ordinary individual is too weak, both politically and financially, to oppose a giant organization, observed Lou. There exists no justice for little people. But guns make every person equal, he noted. Extraordinary action has to be taken to preserve this world as a better place to live. Close quote. So on an overcast November day, Lou made his way to room 309, a windowless seminar room in Van Allen Hall. James Van Allen himself, the renowned space physicist whose name is also attached to the Earth's radiation belts, sat in his office up on the 7th floor. Lou took a seat and waited for the regular Friday afternoon meeting of the Space Physics Theory Group to begin. About 10 minutes into the session, with the physicist at the chalkboard giving a talk, Lou stood up and, to everyone's surprise, pulled out a gun and shot Gertz, Shahn, and Robert Allen Smith, another member of Lou's dissertation committee. Lou then walked down to the 2nd floor and killed Dwight R. Nicholson, the physics department chairman. Lou's final stop was the administration building, where he killed T. Ann Clary, the associate vice chancellor for academic affairs, who was the highest level administrator to reject Lou's dissertation prize appeal. Lou then killed himself. Theodore Strelesky murdered Stanford University mathematics professor Carol DeLew on August 18, 1978. At the time of the murder, Strelesky was in his 16th year as a graduate student in Stanford's mathematics department, an experience that had left him feeling disrespected and ripped off. From the beginning, attending the prestigious private school had been a financial struggle for Strelesky, who had very little money. Early on, he says he was told by DeLew that he would have to give up his part-time job at Lockheed Corporation while studying at Stanford. But the department didn't give Strelesky any financial support, and so he had to attend Stanford intermittently between low-paying jobs. Strelesky was socially naive. He didn't play the games that would have ingratiated him with the department. Honest and straightforward, he thought he would be rewarded simply for achieving the technical mastery of mathematics required by the department. So he was disillusioned when, after passing the qualifying examination, the department still didn't offer him financial support. He felt that DeLew didn't even take his inquiry seriously. Relegated to permanent outsider status, Strelesky had a difficult time finding a thesis advisor, and he suffered a series of casual put-downs by DeLew, from whom he took 7 mathematics courses. These seemingly minor incidents alarmed Strelesky, because they indicated that he didn't have the professorial favor needed to get good letters of recommendation or even to be awarded a Ph.D. Thus, after years of sacrifice and slavish study, it was becoming apparent to Strelesky that he would have no future in mathematics, the field to which he had devoted his life. Moreover, his marriage collapsed under the financial and academic pressure, which transformed him from a gentle person into a sometimes violent one. Stanford had left him with nothing, and with nothing to lose. The turning point came when an abstract of Strzelecki's discoveries in mathematics was deemed publishable, a sign to him that his troubles were the result not of his failings as a mathematician, but of the department's abusiveness. It was time to act. Furious about the years of unfair treatment, he was willing to pay any price to be able to badmouth Stanford and do it with some impact. He considered going to the alumni, the students, or the media, but he felt he had no standing. The media don't cover struggling graduate students, he noted, but they do cover murders. Of course, one should take issue with this reasoning, but more social means of fighting back are unlikely to look feasible to socially isolated individuals like Strzelecki. Because different people respond to frustration in different ways, some violently. Institutional injustice makes violence inevitable. Strzelecki decided to target the professor whom he felt had done the most to block his career and his life. He envisioned the killing both as a real and as a symbolic act of self-defense against an individual and an institution that had virtually destroyed him. He brought a 2-pound sledgehammer to campus, found DeLue in his office grading exams, and bashed him on the head. Strzelecki then turned himself into the police. He maintained that the killing was a morally correct action and a political statement about the way Stanford treats its graduate students. After his arrest, Strzelecki refused to submit to psychiatric examination, and he pressured his court-appointed lawyer into entering a simple not guilty plea instead of the not guilty by reason of insanity plea that the lawyer wanted to use. Strzelecki considered that the Stanford math faculty had to be arrogant and powerful, and so he also made his lawyer agree to put them on the witness stand as a way of putting them on the spot. Strzelecki took the stand himself and testified about his reasons for killing DeLue. In the end, the jury was unable to see Strzelecki as an inherently bad person, and so convicted him of second-degree murder rather than first-degree murder, although the prosecutor was outraged, calling the verdict almost illegal. Strzelecki got a short sentence, which prison officials made even shorter by awarding him time off for good behavior. Ironically, it was only in prison that Strzelecki was finally able to devote all of his attention to mathematics, just as his wealthy or financially supported fellow students had been able to do at Stanford. Thus, he described prison as a utopia with constraints, and joked that he had a tenured position with a state institution. To the distress of many, Strzelecki achieved his goal of criticizing Stanford with some impact. He got wide media coverage, including a sympathetic profile in People magazine and a guest appearance on Phil Donahue's show. Imprisoned for 7 years and 20 days, Strzelecki has been a free man since September 8, 1985.